Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. It's quite an honor to follow these previous authors. Glad I'm not right before lunch, but I guess the trade-off is I'm right before the cash bar. So I'm going to talk about some work we've done with greenhouse gas emissions from both traditional and biofuels cropping systems, and also look at an energy balance in those cropping systems. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors. We did this work at the Purdue University Agronomy Farm, and Sylvie Brodeur is kind of the project lead for the entire project. Dennis Buholtz is our database manager. Work with Martha Zwanicher and the folks at the Iowa Soybean Association on some energy issues. And then Sajib and Graham Eager, Ag Econ, and then the rest of the authors are with Purdue's Agronomy Department working on this project. I saw an article in the paper yesterday saying that there will be 7 billion people in the next few days. To me, that's an astounding number of people. And in addition to providing the food, fiber, and feed for all these people, it seems we're moving into an era where we're also expected to provide the fuel in agriculture for all these people. Not only do we have federal initiatives on biofuels, but each state seems to be taking their own initiatives, with California taking the lead on much of this. And they've passed legislation that are regulations that will require a reduction in the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from fuel by 10% in 10 years. The regulated party is the fuel supplier, and biofuels are one of the few ways where the fuel supplier can reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or carbon footprint. Greenhouse gas life cycle assessment is key to unlocking this huge market for biofuels. And it's not only California that's looking at this. It's also the other states on the West Coast, much of the northeastern states, and I believe the Midwestern governors have recently met within the last year or so to discuss similar issues. When we look at a life cycle analysis, this one happens to be for soybeans, but you start with the fertilizer manufacturer, go through the farming systems, and look at emissions from the land use and the cropping systems, and you follow that through the transportation to the processing facility, the processing, distribution and storage, and all the way out to the operation of the vehicle. And most of the area where we're focusing, of course, is on this portion of this life cycle analysis. The objectives that I'll talk about today are to compare biofuels to traditional Corn Belt cropping systems, to look at greenhouse gas emissions, also take a look at both direct and indirect energy inputs into these systems, and then try to also take a little bit of a look at both grain as well as cellulosic ethanol, or since we do have soybeans in these rotations, look biodiesel energy yields. The plots that we use, there are 48 plots, so four replications of each of these treatments. The first five are our biofuels treatments. So we have a restored prairie, miscanthus, switchgrass, and continuous sorghum. And even on this, we harvest all of the residue. And then a little bit more intensive cropping system here with continuous corn, where we're harvesting all of that residue for potential biofuel production. Then we have our traditional cropping systems. We have two corn-soybean rotation. So each year we have at least one crop, one set of these plots in corn and the other one in soybeans. This one we have all the nitrogen fertilizer applied before planting. In this one, we have all of the nitrogen applied as side dress, and it's at a lower fertility rate. And then we have two continuous corn treatments with all of the nitrogen supplied either through manure applied in the spring or manure applied in the fall. And we use swine manure for that. And then a continuous corn that's kind of the analog of these corn-soybean treatments. This is what the water quality field station looks like with the 48 plots. And it's a very unique site to do environmental work on cropping systems because not only are we able to look at greenhouse gas emissions on these plots, but they're also fitted with, in the center, the whole plot is 10 meters wide by 48.5 meters long. But in the very center of the plot is a lysimeter that has its own dedicated drainage line. So other researchers in the group are able to look at the water quality implications of these treatments. So looking at the yields, obviously the biomass yields produce greater total tonnage compared to where we harvest for the grain. Although it seems to be much more variable than what we have with the grain yields. Moving into what we get for our fluxes throughout the year. As with most other greenhouse gas emission studies, we see kind of this trend of increasing emissions as we move into the growing season, peaking throughout the summer, and then returning to lower levels as our temperatures cool off. Something interesting here is that the prairie grass treatment consistently resulted in the greatest carbon dioxide emissions. Looking at methane emissions, as with most other studies, pretty much all of the emissions are right around zero, either slight emitters or slight sequestering methane, with the exception of course, where we apply manures, either in the spring or in the fall. And then looking at our nitrous oxide emissions, we get significantly greater nitrous oxide emissions with our manure treatments early in the season. And then this year happened to be 2010, was a very wet spring for us. So we got out and started our measurements, expecting planting to come very soon. And then we went a little more than a month without being able to do any field activities because of how wet the year turned out to be. But as soon as we could get back in the field, they started applying fertilizers, and we saw peaks in all of the nitrous oxide emissions where we applied fertilizers. I know this is difficult to read. Really, the only thing to see when we group everything all together is that in our manure, spring manure treatment, we get greater methane losses throughout the entire year compared with any of the other treatments. We look at carbon dioxide emissions, and the main point that we see here is that these first treatments here, where we have our grasses, is where we see the greatest CO2 emissions from these systems. And looking at nitrous oxide emissions for the whole years, typically the nitrous oxide is much lower from these biofuels treatments that don't receive very much manure. This is the continuous corn treatment right there. And then we have the prairie grass, miscanthus, and switchgrass. Our data has been used by Sajeev and Ben Gramig to calibrate and validate the DaySimp model, and they report that it does seem to be helping them make the calibrations, and they're moving forward with using this to make some larger scale estimates. We look at carbon dioxide emissions for the whole year and compare that to the biomass yield. This is for our biomass treatments for the estimates of cellulosic ethanol. It's interesting that we see a decreasing trend in our carbon dioxide emissions compared to the biomass yield. If we switch this around and look at those crops that we harvest the grain for, there's virtually no relationship there at all. If we look at the nitrous oxide emissions as a function of the biomass yield, no relationship. But as with, we look at the grain yield, we do see increasing trends of grain yield with nitrous oxide emissions increasing. And this is because as we increase the fertilizer inputs, we also increase the nitrous oxide emissions and increase the biomass yield. Looking at our nitrogen application rate, typically lower CO2 emissions result from our higher nitrogen application rates. It's significant, but it's still quite a shotgun pattern that we have there. And then, as most other studies show, as we increase the amount of nitrogen fertilizer we put down, we increase the amount of nitrogen lost to nitrous oxide emissions. Most of the other studies on this particular farm have shown about 3 to 3.5% of the nitrogen is lost as nitrous oxide. This particular study shows something much closer to the IPCC of around 1.5% of the nitrogen is lost. Moving into how we calculated the cropping attributes, energy inputs. So we have the direct as well as the indirect energy. The direct is anything that we can put anytime we pass over the field. So it's if it's tilling or planting, anytime we pass over to apply a fertilizer or herbicide, harvest, and then also transportation and hauling, and if there's any drying of the grain that's required. Indirect includes both production of the seed as well as any treatments that go on the seed. Production of the manure, although so far the best way that we've decided to handle that based on other expert opinions is that we assume all the energy associated with producing that manure goes with the actual product, whether it be the milk or the eggs or the pork. So we assign a zero energy input for manures. But we do also have numbers for any of the pesticides or fertilizers. So just taking a look at how we did this, this is from 2008 in our continuous corn with all the fertilizer placed pre-plant. So we put on 160 pounds of nitrogen per acre as urea with a urease inhibitor on that. Planted corn at 29,000 seeds per acre and then a burn down herbicide application with three chemicals in the mix, and then didn't do anything else for those plots until harvest. So we calculate the indirect energy for the nitrogen application. So this is only the energy required to produce 160 pounds of nitrogen as urea for this field. and we determine that there are the energy units that we use here are in gallons of diesel fuel equivalent, because in we can go with BTUs or many other units, but gallons of diesel fuel equivalent is what the folks in Iowa can talk to farmers about and give them some relation about how much energy is required for these inputs. So it's really an astounding amount of energy required just for the fertilizer. Looking at the chemical applications, much lower. Surprising that there's that much energy associated with just the seed that's put in the ground, to me. Looking at the direct energy, so if you remember, we had more than 30 gallons of diesel fuel equivalent associated with just the fertilizer application, but based on the way that we place that fertilizer on the ground, two orders of magnitude lower energy required to place that fertilizer on the ground. And most of the people, whenever you talk to them, they think that most of their energy is going to be just the tillage pass or just planting. But it's really interesting to go through these calculations with producers. So we look at all 12 of our treatments, and here we have the direct energy in the black and the indirect energy in the gray. And you can tell in this prairie grass treatment and in these soybean treatments, there is no chemical fertilizer input, at least not from the nitrogen, that's adding much to the indirect energy. The bulk of the energy here is associated from the nitrogen fertilizer applications. And in these two treatments, our direct energy requirements are so high because that's where we apply the manures. And even though we don't have an energy unit associated with the manure itself, it does take a tremendous amount of energy to apply those liquid manures to fields. So we look at the total energy inputs as a function of the nitrogen fertilization rate, and we get a very strong correlation there. The main points that are dragging that down are where we have a zero for the indirect energy from the manure treatments. Take a look at the energy balance, kind of completing the energy balance just for what the crops are producing. For cellulosic ethanol, we're making the assumption that we can make about almost 90 gallons of ethanol per ton of stover. And then the energy associated with that is 76,000 BTU per gallon of ethanol. For grain ethanol, we're assuming that we can produce about 2.7 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn grain. And both of those are from the literature. So looking at our cellulosic energy yields, you can see it's quite variable based on the yield throughout the different years. But we remember we had so much more cellulose or biomass yield from those five plots. We compare where we have no grain to the treatments where we do have some type of grain on that ground. It's very low energy yield from those biomass treatments. And then if we look at the total energy yield as a function of the total energy inputs into the system, we do get a correlation. Somehow I left that regression line off of there, but there is a statistically significant correlation between the energy input and the energy output based on what we would get from the grain or the stover. So in conclusion, the corn and the sorghum treatments resulted in increased greenhouse gas emissions, predominantly nitrous oxide, and are much more energy intensive as far as what's required to grow those crops. We see spikes in the nitrous oxide emissions and that's predominantly following fertilization and the losses that we observed at about 1% of the 1.6% of the nitrogen applied is quite a bit lower than what we've seen on other treatment or other fields on the same farm. Nitrogen fertilizers are the predominant variable that dictate how much total energy input is required to grow these crops. And we see a positive correlation between the total energy out with the total energy in. So, thank you.
Well, there's already a question for you.
Okay. The methane emissions, we use swine manure, so it's a liquid manure. Methane is it's actually one of the odorous components of swine manure. So that's why is why we see methane. Okay, so that red line that you saw was for the spring manure. We have two manure treatments. One of them is for spring, and one of them is for fall manure. So we do both. I'm sorry.
Are there other questions?
Yeah. So do you have any idea from your work about what type of yields you need off your land in order to make these biofuels reasonable?
Right. We haven't got to that point in determining that. I hope to work with Ben Gramig out of the Ag Econ department to answer some of those questions, but I don't have an idea yet of how to answer that question. So.
Is it mostly ethanol, or do you think in biogas?
The numbers I figured here were only for cellulosic ethanol production, but. We should certainly look into other means of generation to see which would be the most efficient.
Your pre-plant nitrogen, could you, perhaps you had it there and I missed it, but could you tell me when it was applied and what the nitrogen source was?
All of our pre-plant nitrogen treatments, the nitrogen source is urea with Nitropan. There is a urease inhibitor with that. And it's typically put on the day before planting. Mm-hmm. Actually, accounting for that part of it was a little bit difficult because in 2008, all of those miscanthus were transplanted. So, to be honest, the numbers I have for 2008 are probably inaccurate because I did not account for transplanting of the miscanthus. It's a perennial crop in those plots now, so there is no energy associated with planting that in subsequent years.
Are
Yes. I'd like to look at the entire life cycle. To this point, we've only been able to look at that particular, the component that I've shown. But we do need to look at transportation, other sources of generation of energy from the biofuels. So, yeah, there are many other things that we need to do. So.
All right. Are there any other questions?
One more. Timing was a component of your nitrogen treatments where you had fertilizer nitrogen.
Yes, sir.
In your scatter of points there, I was wondering, could you pick out any pattern with respect to timing? Did timing make a difference?
The way that it's set up, the timing also has a rate factor. So our pre-plant nitrogen is applied at 160 pounds per acre. Our side dress application is 120 pounds per acre. So there's some confounding issues there that it's not quite as easy to do that.
All right, well, I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Smith.